Hope is a virtue as crucial as it is unknown. It can be compared to a cord formed by two intertwined threads, much like the virtue of piety, which is a secure trust in our Father God, and the virtue of prudence, which is discernment. First and foremost, there is security. God's gifts and calling are irrevocable, as written by St. Paul. God fulfills his promises and carries forth his works. He promised the elderly Abraham, married to the barren Sarah, a numerous offspring from which the Messiah would come. Shortly afterward, Isaac was born. But you see, God asked for Isaac as a sacrifice. Abraham, without understanding or seeking consolation, hoped against all hope and journeyed with Isaac to Mount Moriah. As you can see, he was rewarded and God's promise was fulfilled. Beyond imagination, he sent his son, whom he allowed to die as a sacrifice on Mount Moriah. This work is not a human endeavor but a great supernatural undertaking that began or was fulfilled in it. How much is needed for it to be rightfully called God's work, without boast? Saint Josemaria expressed. Therefore, have a deep conviction that heaven is committed to its realization. Hope is security and peace, as Charles said. The virtue that most impresses God in humans is hope. Faith and charity endure through the ages, but my little hope is the one that lies down every night and rises every morning, sleeping truly peacefully. Secondly, there is discernment. However, hope has nothing to do with passive quietism like everything will be fine. Optimism about the success of specific matters at hand here and now is fundamentally different from the theological virtue of hope. It concerns contingent realities and needs reasoned thought to avoid degenerating into ideology. In the 6th century before Christ, Nebuchadnezzar led his army against Jerusalem. All prophets predicted God's people would be victorious, except Jeremiah. He urged the king to seek peace before fighting against a militarily superior power. After the conquest of Jerusalem and the deportation to Babylon, only Jeremiah, the prophet of pessimism, kept the flame of hope alive, saying they would return to Jerusalem in 70 years because they were the chosen people. Hope gazes at the future while discerning the present. It is the little sister leading faith and charity hand in hand. In trials, it recognizes God purifying his works. Instead of rebelling, it deciphers his message. In this regard, I strongly recommend reading the book Wisdom of a Poor by Hello and Leclerc, both for its style and content. Passivity and activism are ideologies. They seem opposite but share a human perspective. They differ only in that the activist relies more on their strength and the pessimist less. When faced with trials, both become confused and might even lack charity. Lack of unity in the church leads to sterility and death. CSS distinguishes three types of employees: the servant who merely fulfills tasks, the supplicant who eagerly devotes themselves to work, and the child who considers the work their own while resting in their father. God desires children. San Buenaventura compares the security and discernment of hope to a bird's flight, looking up to God while using all its strength to move its wings. To hope is to fly. What does the Lord expect from the work at this moment? Perhaps in Pope Francis's disposition, one can recognize a call to become more charismatic and simpler. Firstly, more charismatic, Luigino Bruni, an economics professor, discusses how charismatic organizations, religious or otherwise, start with creative flourishing under the founder's guidance but can later turn into ideologies. This moment may be an opportunity for the Opus Dei to embrace its charism and promote its evangelizing actions. To be more creative, to truly believe in their vocation, to identify with Christ through secular realities, to love the postmodern world, and to develop a creative fidelity. Perhaps the work has gone through a similar process after the passing of Saint Josemaria. Fidelity to the founder's spirit led to detailed regulations. Legal matters continued, gaining weight. This happened during a transition to postmodernity, which erases references and drives the search for security. All this might have caused rigidity in the work, voluntarism, and excessive regulation, potentially distorting the charism. At this moment, through Pope Francis, God might wish to protect the Opus Dei's charism and encourage its evangelizing actions, calling for more belief in their charism, which involves complete dedication in the world, identifying with Christ through secular realities, and becoming people of discernment. Secondly, the Lord might be calling the Opus Dei to become simpler from an organizational perspective. Pope Francis aims to confirm the Opus Dei's prelature in the truly charismatic context of the Church, aligning its organization with the Founder's teachings and the Council's ecclesiology on personal prelatures. This is to promote a governance based more on charism than hierarchical authority. The goal is to protect the unique gift of the work spirit. As Saint Josemaria said, "What we desire is simply this, to harmonize the charism, the specific vocation we have received from God, with the norm, with a suitable legal statute that we can legitimately use with interior and exterior security before God, the Church, and humanity." This move towards institutional or structural simplicity might be supported by three aspects. Firstly, the regulation in the Code of Personal Prelatures is concise and refers to their own statutes. Secondly, the Opus Dei's adaptation of its statutes to new norms. The approval of these new statutes depends on whether recent legal reforms will have practical consequences for the members. Secondly, even if, in fact, nothing were to change, it is necessary to clarify the scope of assimilating prelatures to clerical associations. Assimilating is not the same as identifying, it's a legal technique that avoids repetition and facilitates the interpretation of new forms. It could be understood that, according to the purpose of prelatures, they could consist of priests and lay people, in which case Opus Dei could fit into this new, simpler version of personal prelatures. However, an interpretation that identifies prelatures with clerical associations would be incompatible with the secular charism of the work. Its purpose is to promote the sanctification of its lay members, who represent 98%. Only a few are ordained and incardinated for the service of others. Thus, it would be forced to relegate the secular character of the work to the background, and the predominant task carried out by clergy would become primary. This would, in some way, be a step back to the approval of 1947 as the Priestly Society of the Holy Cross, associated with Opus Dei, which the founder requested due to its suitability in the 1917 Code for the Incardination of Priests. And thirdly, while unlikely, if prelature and clerical association were identified instead of assimilated, the work would cease to be a prelature. In that hypothetical case, the Opus Dei might need to reconsider its legal path to find a suitable solution. The Pope might initiate a reform of the Code of Canon Law to create a legal structure appropriate to Opus Dei's charism, simple yet fitting. This structure should possess the following characteristics: it must have a vocational content, not only for carrying out certain associative activities, it should be secular, not religious or primarily clerical, it should be primarily composed of lay people, it should have the capacity to integrate priests in service to these lay people, and finally, it should be universally applicable under the authority of a prelate. To conclude with a relevant reference, I'd like to mention Professor Immons, who headed the Canon Law School in Munich and recently passed away. Early in his career, he was a strong critic of personal prelatures, but in later years, he nuanced his stance. From a charismatic perspective, in line with Pope Francis, he believed that charism substantially contributes to the historical form of the gospel, demanding a welcoming requirement specifically from the church hierarchy. Even if it involves a transfer. I don't want to end this series without expressing my gratitude to those who have read this far. Your effort is appreciated. As passionate as this topic might be, it remains challenging. I'd also like to apologize to legal specialists for any legal inaccuracies that might have been made throughout this series. And to everyone else, as this series contains personal opinions that you might not share or assertions that need nuance or correction. I'll conclude with a small anecdote. This series, by coincidence, ends today, August 23, 2023. Well, 41 years ago, on this very day, Don Alvaro was present as the prelate at the Opus Dei headquarters in a place called Cava Bianca in Rome, waiting for the announcement from Pope John Paul II that the work would be established as a personal prelature. After dinner, he usually had a chat with those who lived with him. And one of these days, while awaiting the Vatican's call to announce the news the next day, someone remarked that the following day would be excellent because it's the feast of Saint Pius X, a saint the Opus Dei had chosen as an intercessor for its relations with the Holy See. But just then, the phone rang, and it was said that San Juan Pablo II would make that decision public the next day. Amidst this, someone mentioned that it was the 23rd of August, to which Don Alvaro responded, "It's astonishing." On August 23, 1971, San Josemaria had a locution, a message from the Lord. It said, "Let's go with love, joy, and confidence to the throne of glory to obtain mercy." Thus, he named the Virgin the throne of glory. They had this phrase engraved on a bas-relief on the exterior wall of the place. It depicted the Virgin crowned by the Trinity, with the date, August 23, 1971. And today, coincidentally, it's also August 23rd. Many years have passed since those days, 52 years since that August 23rd and 41 years since Don Alvaro's comment. Yet the Virgin, the throne of glory, remains, always there for us to obtain mercy.